Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, I have the dual pleasure today of speaking with Dr. James Mallison, who is a reader in Indology and Yoga Studies at SOAS University of London, and also Peter Santo, who is currently associate professor and head of the department of Tibetan and Buddhist Studies at ELT. We'll be talking about a very interesting new publication central to all things yoga called the Amrita Siddhi and the Amrita Siddhi Mula, the earliest texts of the Hatha Yoga tradition, critically edited and translated by both of my guests today. Gentlemen, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Raj. Thanks very much for asking us on.
Thank you very much indeed for inviting us.
Oh, my pleasure. The pleasure is all ours. You know, this, before we dive into the book, you know, there is a certain gravitas in all things yoga at SOAS. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the center, the interest in yoga, and maybe a little bit about your own fascinating and influential path?
Well, I joined SOAS at the end of 2013, and there was already an MA in yoga and meditation studies that had been set up by Professor Ulrich Pagel. So I can't take any credit for getting the ball rolling at SOAS. But then straight away, I put in, well, within a few months, I put in an application for one of these big ERC grants for a project called the Hatha Yoga Project. And to my delight, got lucky with that and assembled a team of really excellent scholars of yoga, both kind of modern yoga and traditional historical yoga. And then about halfway through the project, which ran from 2015 to 2021, I applied to set up the SOAS Center for Yoga Studies. And that's over 2018 that got going. And that's been a great success as well. We've been putting on lectures. In fact, you know, through the pandemic, we went online, of course, and we've continued doing that because that's really sort of expanded our audience. Our online lectures get loads of people viewing and listening. And we do summer schools and various other courses. You just had a couple of my colleagues, Jackie Hargreaves and Ruth Westerby were on talking about these new pod courses. So there's all kinds of stuff going on. And it has become a sort of a hub, I think, for international yoga studies.
Oh, without question. And as you mentioned, we just recently had a conversation about the new yoga studies online platform, and SOAS has gone online. And I'm not sure how it happened, but I appear to live these days at the intersection of sort of Hindu studies and online platforms. So here we are. So the Amrita Siddhi, you know, what is this work? You know, what is the Amrita Siddhi, and perhaps a bit about why it might be important to look at it?
Okay, well, so as part of the Hatha Yoga Project, the core of that research project was the production of 10 critical editions of important Sanskrit texts on physical yoga. And the earliest of those, of the 10 that we proposed to edit, is this text, the Amrita Siddhi. which is the earliest known text on physical yoga. It doesn't call its yoga Hatha Yoga. That comes a little bit later, not much later. And I got a manuscript. I mean, a long time ago, I got manuscripts. You know, when I was during my PhD, I was wandering around India, going to lots of libraries and getting as many manuscripts as I could. And I got a couple from Jodhpur of the Amrita Siddhi. And I remember I was on a holiday holiday in northern England, and I think it was 2007, and the weather was so terrible, I spent most of the time indoors. And I read this manuscript of the Amrita Siddhi, one of the Jodhpur ones, and quickly realized that it was a hugely important text. It was very, seminal is quite a good pun because of the name of the text and what it's all about, but it's definitely seminal for the future Hatha Yoga corpus. And so slowly gathered more and more manuscripts of it over the years and started working on preliminary critical editions. I read it twice in groups in Oxford with Professor Alexis Sanderson. And then finally, having badgered Professor Curtis Schaefer, who's at University of Virginia, he was the first person who brought this text to public knowledge with an article on it published in 2002, which he was mainly working from this bilingual Sanskrit Tibetan manuscript, probably from the 12th century. There's flexibility there, might not definitely be, but it definitely has origins in at least the 12th century, maybe a copy of a 12th century manuscript, which was way older than any of the ones I'd been working on and collating for the edition. So finally got hold of scans of that from him. And then with Peter in Oxford, Peter was then a fellow of All Souls, and we read the edition, I think, was it with the Lexis? That I can't remember. We read it so many times, so many different groups. It all sort of slightly melts into one. But we read the edition with this latest manuscript collated, or we were reading it as we were going, and it slowly became apparent. You know, when you have I say slowly, it was actually, now looking back, really obvious from the start, or not from the start, but as soon as we started working closely on it, that there were features of the text which had been completely incomprehensible to me, but made perfectly good sense to Peter, because they were, it would be teachings or terminology from Vajrayana Buddhism, so Tantric Buddhism, of which Peter is a great expert. And also, of course, the manuscript had a Tibetan translation of the Sanskrit with it, so Peter was able to read that, which I wasn't. And fairly quickly, as I realized how important it was going to be to have some expertise in Tantric Buddhism in order to make sense of the text, which I do not have, I invited Peter to collaborate with me on the edition as part of the Hatha Yoga project. And to my delight, he said yes. And that sort of set off a few years of a very pleasurable collaboration.
So many fascinating threads to be touched on. Peter, tell us a little bit about the role of your expertise in Tantric Buddhism. Why is that significant for this text? Tell us about perhaps the relationship and that we can sort of piece together in the world behind the text. I mean, are notions such as Buddhism or Tantric Buddhism anachronistic? I mean, are they coming from a shared sort of cultural ethos? You know, tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, well, you ask very complicated questions. These are indeed very important.
All naive questions.
Well, indeed. No, not naive at all. These are really the questions, which obviously we cannot answer comprehensively. What was really interesting about this collaboration, so what we both learned from Alexis Sanderson, we were both his students, is to read as widely as possible and to read as many kinds of text as possible. So it was somehow as part of that exercise that I joined these readings with Jim. And so in a way, I started as a kind of an innocent bystander. And then actually, I remember the time we were in my rooms in All Souls, and we got to this particular verse. The author is just about to launch into teaching his great teaching, which is the centerpiece of the work. And he says, well, you should be doing this because that other practice doesn't work. And that other practice was a curious word, which the yoga experts in the room did not realize, but it made perfect sense to me. So for me, that was kind of the Tetris moment, you know, when the four little blocks fall into place. I was like, aha, so this is the key. And then following on that trail, we did realize that there is a lot of Buddhism in this text, but perhaps we shouldn't overemphasize the Buddhist background. I mean, by this time, Buddhism is already very, very eclectic and is taking a lot from Shaivism and from India. But there was something about the terminology which was rather unusual and which was only transmitted in this very old manuscript, which the other transmissions sort of edited out discreetly or less discreetly. So that's what really excited me to take part in this project, because I am fascinated with this tantric Buddhist world in India, which I believe was a rather small majority, but what they lacked in numbers, they made up in the sheer, well, vastness of what they managed to write, and the sheer variety and indeed bewildering variety of their practices. So pulling these two strands together was really, in a way, it was quite surprising. We didn't expect that this would be something like this would be standing at the basis of Hatha Yoga. So really a very interesting world opened up, which even we didn't expect in the beginning. As for what tantric Buddhism is a very interesting question. It sort of starts somewhere in the 6th or 7th century, perhaps in India. They say that, hey, we have here a new set of meditation and ritual technologies which can get you to the goal, i.e. to become a Buddha much quicker. So that's the basic ethos of esoteric Buddhism. That's what it does. But then things do take a turn, and around about 100 years later, they become what we call antinomian or transgressive. So they start doing practices which go against social norms and monastic ethics and even just, you know, standard human ethics. And they really take this idea of reaching non-duality through the cancellation of opposites in a very serious way. So ritually pure, ritually impure, things that are allowed, things that are not allowed. So to this end, they developed a set of really interesting and sometimes rather strange practices. And this kind of yoga, what we see in this text, sort of comes at the tail end of this story, when we already do have a very, very mature and well-developed tantric Buddhism, but the religion always changes, and that's what's so interesting about it. There are new ideas, new practices coming in all the time, and this is really part of that story, I think.
So how might have Hatha Yoga been characterized prior to this text, or otherwise put, what sorts of dimensions are opened up by this thread in this text? And maybe just in passing, mention to the best of our academic knowledge, when are we talking about?
Well, as Jim said, this old manuscript that we could access is dated 1169, was it? If I remember correctly. But then we realized that actually this is a copy of a manuscript which was penned in 1169. So it must come from that before that time. And with a couple of very, very faint traces, we could push it back perhaps even maybe a century more. So definitely after the turn of the millennium, that's the environment that we are talking about. At least that's what we have evidence for. What really happened, we can never say. We can only follow the evidence.
Could either of you tell us a little bit about the critical edition process? And we've touched on this in a number of podcasts, whether, talking about the Mahabharata project or the Puranas, etc. But, you know, what was that process like for you? You know, what how many manuscripts did you start off with, and what might that have looked like for you?
Well, I'm afraid I was the one charged with constructing the critical edition mostly, and it was rather torturous because we used definitely more than 10 manuscripts. I can't remember the exact number. Was it 14 or something like that? So basically what we do is something that we all do every day. So when you read the newspaper, if you see some kind of mistake, you sort of automatically correct it and say, oh, this is what the author must have meant. So, you know, roughly put, that's what we do. Manuscript cultures are extremely fragile in transmission, so mistakes can creep in all the time. Things are misread, things are miscopied, the scribe is tired, hungry, what have you, and they make mistakes. So in an ideal situation, we have several manuscripts of a text, which we try to collect, and then we compare them. And we sort of try to hack back to what the author's actual text was. But of course, we can only go that far. We can probably never really, really reconstruct to 100% accuracy. But based on the evidence, this is the best we can do. So it's a lot of reading and checking and weighing one reading against the other. And there are various principles according to which we do these things. Unfortunately, we also had some kind of Tibetan translation, so we were also informed how translators 800, 900 years ago dealt with this text. So it's a very complex and very detailed process, which needs checking again and again and again. And even up to the last minute, Jim and I kept changing our minds about this reading or the other, because we also find parallels. So let's say when the text is quoted somewhere, then we compare it with that. But then you have the same story with the other text which quotes it. So it's, really, really complex, to put it mildly.
So how is the text in hand currently structured?
I think it's 35 chapters. They're called Vivekas. And the first 10 of them, they detail the tattvas, the important elements of the yogic body, the body of the yogi. And this is where the argument comes in. And this is really interesting, actually, I think, the first bit. And it's one of these texts. It's so rich and so complex. And as Peter said, you know, you have to read it in great detail. And also, we really benefited from reading it with lots of other people in these large groups. We had various workshops here and there, and really required the input of experts in all kinds of different fields. But the first 10 verses, they detail these tattvas, these important elements of the body, which are to be manipulated in yogic practice. And it makes the very bold claim. In fact, I mean, going back to what Peter was saying about the editing practice at first, there's a verse which I can't quote it perfectly exactly, but it says it gives that usual tantric and even sort of esoteric, global esoteric maxim of so what's above, you know, so above, so below, you know, everything that's in the macrocosm is in the microcosm. But then we were reading it wrong, and it was through getting this older manuscript and then looking at some of the readings and the other witnesses, we realized that actually what it's saying is that everything that's in the macrocosm in the universe is also in the body, but there are also some things in the body which are not found anywhere else. And it's only through manipulating them that you can attain liberation, nirvana, as the text calls it at the end. So in fact, and then this point is repeated in different ways in this section of 10 chapters, where it's said two or three times that mental practices, meditative practice, will not get you to the final goal. You know, you basically says you can't control the mind with the mind in the same way that you can't control fire with fire and so forth. So it's really saying ultimately that only by manipulating the body can you get liberation, nirvana. So I think it's quite interesting, the context of today's sort of modern yoga practice, where people say, oh, it's all about the body now, and they've forgotten these important meditative practice. That's what it's actually all about. In fact, this text says, no, all that meditation is completely pointless, and you should just do these practices which work on the body. And so having detailed the tattvas in the body, the next four chapters are about the actual practices. The 14th one is a summary, but 11, 12, and 13 detail the individual practices, which are quite simple. I mean, they took us a while to work out what on earth was going on, because the text is written in a fairly obscure way, certainly in parts. But they are relatively simple physical postures, and they involve they're to be done in sequence, and the third one involves lifting yourself up and dropping yourself on the ground, and that's meant to make the accumulated breath shoot up the central column, and you should do that over and over again, but make it burst through various knots along the central channel, and then that eventually leads to liberation. And then the remaining chapters, we have four chapters on the different grades of practitioner. And then the rest of the text is about what happens as you progress through the four stages of yoga practice. That's a summary of what's in it.
Compared to other Hatha Yoga texts, and we've always touched on much of this, but what's most striking or unique or interesting about this text?
It's interesting. One would normally think of teachings getting more complicated over time and getting added to. But in fact, if we look at the Hatha corpus, the subsequent texts, which almost all draw in some way or other on the Amrita Siddhi, they seem to express a less detailed understanding of what's actually going on in the yogic body throughout these processes. So it gives you a lot of detail. It really explains what the different winds are doing as you go through the practices and so forth. But another point, maybe not directly answering your question, but a point I'd like to make sure I make is that also over time, over recent years, I've come to the conclusion that this text is actually the first text that teaches any physical yoga practices beyond simple seated postures for meditation. I mean, I used to think, and I've said this in, you know, my PhD doctoral thesis was then published as a book on Khetri Mudra, the book's Khetri Vidya. And I said this, that I thought that these distinctive Hatha yoga physical practices were ancient and then only get written down about 1,000 years ago. But I think now the evidence is so great that the absence of evidence of any evidence whatsoever for any of these practices prior to the advent of the Amrita Siddhi is so great that I think it really represents the origins of physical yoga practice in India. So yeah, I thought I'd get that point across as well. I mean, we make this in the introduction of the book. And then another something that we discovered sort of fairly late on in our work on the book as well is that quite a lot of the sort of theory and the principles behind the yoga practice taught in the book, we find also in Chinese texts from the same period and slightly earlier, in fact, in China. It requires a lot more comparative work. It's the sort of thing that would be great for a huge research project. But what we don't find, what I haven't found in the, obviously I'm reading in translation and secondary sources, but haven't found any the practices themselves. It seems to be the principles surrounding it, this idea of within the yogic body you've got the sun and the moon, and they're moving around and you've got to line them up and so forth. We do find those in slightly earlier Chinese texts, but not actually the practices that are taught in the Amrita Siddhi that manipulate those elements within the body. I would reiterate that it really is seminal for the ongoing Hatha Yoga corpus. Lots of the ideas that are first articulated in that text then become absolutely fundamental to later discourse on Hatha Yoga.
Would you characterize so textured a text as coming from or featuring predominantly a particular worldview or darshana or strand of Hinduism?
Of what, the Amrita Siddhi itself? Well, I think Hinduism, obviously, I don't think we can consider, because I'd say it was certainly composed in a Buddhist milieu. But I mean, Peter can say more about this. But from my understanding, very much a heterodox Buddhist milieu. It's sort of, you know, saying the point is that it's when it's arguing against others, it's using Buddhist terminology always, and quite obscure, relatively esoteric Buddhist terminology. I don't know if Peter would agree with that, but that's my understanding.
I find that really fast.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
There's not much philosophy in the text. I really think that the point of the author was to delineate and to teach a practice, which either, well, not he, but his master or his masters have discovered. And really the drive of the whole thing is to sort of get rid of philosophical ideas and all sorts of ritual paraphernalia, and just to concentrate on this really, really intense physical practice that the author sees as the key to liberation. I mean, in that way, it's more or less similar to everything that went on in India, because everyone wants liberation. That's the ultimate goal of all darshanas. But there is not a lot of philosophy in there. So
One of the fascinating threads, you know, I mean, there are no shortage of interesting things about this text. But I was recently teaching a course on the Mahavidyas, these esoteric tantric goddesses. And I was fascinated to see knowledge of Chinamasta, for example. So clearly, this is a very rich the praxis that's surrounding this text, which we can only conjecture into, but it seems clear that the proponents of this text or its authors were well aware and engaged in a variety of esoteric tantric traditions. Would you say that's a fair characterization?
Yeah, sure. I mean, among the 10 Mahavidyas, we do find two which are Buddhist. And of course, the Mahavidya tradition is very Eastern. So it's from the Bengal, what is now Bengal, Bangladesh area. And this was really the hotbed for innovation as far as Tantric Buddhism goes. This was really the center for this religion. So I don't find that surprising. I mean, we do see when Buddhism gradually disappears from East India, we do see a lot being preserved in quote-unquote Hindu texts. I mean, I always use Hindu in scare quotes because, it's a very complicated term.
Well, without question, it's sort of it's not a species or a genus, it's more of a jungle. You know, the term Hindu and folks treat it like a species or a genus, but it's really just a label for an ecosystem of ideas that may or may not overlap with what we think of other quote unquote world religions. But
ecosystem is very good. I'm going to use that. Thanks.
It's how I teach it. Well, feel free to use it, but I hope that I can use the when the Tetris piece falls into place because I thought that's a great. And I wasn't particularly into video games, but there are moments in studying the frame of certain Mahabharata stories and Markandeya Purana stories where that's what it felt like. The Tetris piece lined up and it was like, boom, you figured something out.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sorry for our young viewers. They're going to have to look up what is Tetris. But I think people from our generation used to play it under the desk in school. So yeah, let's just say the aha moment. And really, these are the moments that we live for. These are such gratifying, wonderful moments when somehow things drop into place and now I see it makes sense. So yeah, in that way, it was very, very gratifying to work on this book.
So tell us, you know, is the Hatha Yoga project is formally over, but what's the next step in terms of this work or this line of thought?
In terms of the Hatha Yoga project as a whole, we've still got plenty of outputs to finalize. You know, there are lots of, I think two or three critical editions have been accepted for publication and, you know, final revision and indexing. And I've got three that are sort of between 95 and 85% done. It's just those last bits of pushing them over the line. There's an edited volume about to come out. That was a very interesting workshop that my colleagues, Mark Singleton and Daniela Bevilacqua, put together looking at possible influences on physical yoga practice from other traditions, such as dance and martial arts and that sort of thing, which was generally, in fact, apart going back to the point I made about China, the only presentation, there was a very good presentation by a young doctoral student. I think she's now completed her PhD called, I can't remember, Dolly Yang. I think that's the name, but that was showing the overlaps with Chinese practice and between Chinese practice and Hatha Yoga. So that volume's about to come out. Jason and I Jason Birch and I are working on two new projects, one to do a critical edition of the Hatha Pradipika with the University of Marburg. Professor Jürgen Haneda there is the PI in Marburg. And then we have another project with Professor Sherman Hatley at the University of Boston, University of Massachusetts, Boston, to edit a text called the Yoga Chintamani. I really should have finished the other project first because now I have way too much on my plate. But the Hatha Yoga project, the work we've done there has really enabled these other two projects because the Hatha Yoga corpus is so intertextual, it's crazy. I mean, it just becomes, as Peter sort of pointed out already, some of the complications we get of editing the text, and we realize that, you know, the text was borrowed a verse from that text, but that text has two different recensions in which, and then the later commentator draws from one recension of the text, and it's, the whole thing is such a minefield. You know, as Peter was saying, with an individual text, we can draw a schematic diagram of how the different manuscripts are related. But then we can then extend that to the whole Hatha Yoga corpus. And I think, I mean, it's something I find fascinating, but I think if I really do try to make sense of it, I'll go completely mad because it is so, so complicated. But that's, yeah, the reason that these projects on the Hatha Pradipika and Yoga Chintamani have been enabled by the Hatha Yoga project is because the Hatha Pradipika in particular is at least sort of 50% borrowings from earlier texts. And the text that it borrows most from, we've edited as part of the Hatha Yoga project. So you could look at it like a house of cards, but it is a bit like that at the moment. But I think we're slowly establishing the more solid foundation so that we can really make sense of this whole corpus.
Two things come to mind. One is an image of you well into your twilight years in your rocking chair somewhere, where the grand unified theory of Hatha Yoga has dawned on you, and it's broken the whole Tetris system. And there you go. But between now and then, I imagine that you will have occasion to return to the podcast and put on the radar of our listeners, many of whom are our specialist colleagues, these fascinating and important works that are being churned out. Those without saying, you're welcome back anytime you'd like to publicize any of them.
Well, thanks very much. Yeah, hopefully there'll be more soon. I have some colleagues I can nudge as well, get them to hurry along so they can get on your podcast as well.
Yeah. If you hurry up, you'll do it before Rob Walcorn hangs up his podcasting mic. So come on, kids. Let's get going. it's really fascinating work. Is there anything else about this particular work or the project at large that you wanted to share?
I think maybe Peter could say something a bit about the Amrita Siddhi Mula and its rich existence, because I think from my point of view, because I work primarily on the Indian tradition, and even though the influence of the text was established early on, and as I say, it's been seminal for the whole subsequent Hatha corpus, the text itself, it gets quoted in a couple of late digests and so forth, but there aren't that many manuscripts of it. It seemed to fall out of use, and some of its practices, you know, the third of the three practices really doesn't seem to be used in India at all anymore. But it went on to have a very rich subsequent tradition in Tibet. So I thought, and that also is reflected in this text, the Amrita Siddhi Mula, which we only have in Tibet. So maybe Peter would like to say a word or two about that.
Yeah, that was really exciting. I mean, in the Tibetan canon, there are quite a few texts which at least nominally want to attach themselves to the Amrita Siddhi. This was certainly the most important one. And for a while, until Jim talked me out of it successfully, I think, I used to think that this really was even earlier than the Amrita Siddhi. But then for various reasons, please read the book, we now think that it's more of a reworking. But indeed, there is a very, very rich corpus, which was sort of kickstarted by this tradition. And this is something that, unfortunately, we didn't have much time to go into. The textual corpus is really, really vast. So if somebody who knows really, really good Tibetan should tackle it, I think that would be very, very fruitful work. That said, one should also have to be cautious, because the quality of these translations, as can be seen from the comments that we make to the Amrita Siddhi Mula, is not that great. So you really have to know what's going on. It's a kind of a Google Translate, as it were. So it takes a lot of experience and a lot of reading in order to be able to reconstruct what the original may have had, which may have been in very bad Sanskrit for all we know. We just don't know. Or some of these texts may have even been composed in Tibet and then sold off as having an Indian provenance. I mean, the questions there are many, And I think this would be a project unto its own.
I've said it before, I'll say it again. The best books are beginnings, not endings. And it sounds very like true. Grad students listening interested in Tibet, who've got some Tibetan, among others, there might be a project here for you. Of course, clear it with your advisor first, and don't blame me if it goes sideways. But anyhow, that sort of opens the door for a question that I often ask on the podcast, which is, who in terms of interest in subfields might most benefit from this work?
Well, anyone interested in the history of yoga in particular, Hatha yoga, physical yoga, I think it's great to have. I'm pretty confident that this is the first text. You know, that I can't see how there could be anything before it. In fact, logically, it almost doesn't make sense. Maybe that sounds absurd, but it makes perfect sense to me that it is the earliest text of the corpus. So that's a good way of understanding what happens subsequently. You know, you need to get to the roots of it, really, to understand the later flourishing of the tradition. So yeah, students of yoga, and I would hope that students of and scholars of Sanskrit and textual criticism as well, because it's a solid critical edition. There haven't been many in the field of yoga, or many more broadly, really, in Indological studies. But both Peter and I, we follow in the tradition of our supervisor Alexis Sanderson, and we remain utterly convinced that the only way really to get to grips with these traditions, with pre-modern Indian religion, is through painstaking long-term philological work and producing critical editions, studying all the manuscripts one can of these kind of texts. So yes, hopefully for philologists, scholars of language as well, and Peter will probably hopefully be of interest to Buddhologists as well. I think it should be.
Absolutely. I mean, I already heard very nice things from colleagues working in Buddhology, so they are definitely reading. In fact, there is a reading group led by one of our common friends, Gergely Hidas, at the Dharmagate Buddhist College here in Budapest. So there were a few students who wanted him to read the text with them. So that's rather fun. It's already being read in classrooms. I think that's very gratifying. At the same time, this is really a scholarly book. So it's a very technical book. I was looking through it today and I was thinking, oh my God, this is really dense. We could have sometimes expanded, but I think both Jim and I are the kind of people who don't like too many words. So if we can say it in one sentence or one footnote, we're going to say it and not just dilute it into 50 pages. But we are thinking about creating a more accessible version of the volume. So stay tuned for that.
Stay tuned. More podcasts. I'm not allowed to retire for the next decade or so from this. Excellent. Well, thank you very much for appearing on the podcast. This is certainly a seminal work, puns intended, and I'm glad that it can be availed for a broader public and scholarly audience, at least in English language. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
For those of you listening, we have been speaking with Jim Allison and Peter Santo on a new translated and newly critically edited work that is seminal to Hatha Yoga, the Amrita Siddhi. Please, all the details, of course, on the podcast notes, as usual. Keep listening. Keep well and keep contemplating all things yoga. Take care.